February 13th. It's 106. Would you call the roll, please?
Yes. Representative Clayman?
Yes.
Oh, that was a vote. We got it.
That was a difficult vote. Right?
Here.
Representative Foster. Representative Keller.
Here.
Representative Lynn.
Here.
Representative Millett and LeDoux are out.
I believe that they're all excused, the ones that aren't here. So, this is Christy, who doesn't like to be known, but this is Christy. That's Alex back there in the corner. Today we have two bills in front of us. There's just four of us. If you have any action that you think the four of us can agree on, now's a chance. No, we are getting information.
But you're a great chair.
On HBA. HB8, and then we'll have public testimony and go to HB79. So if the sponsor for HB8 will come up and tell us about this bill. I have to make a comment that when I see a bill that has that number of pages and so many repeals and reenacts and everything, I realize that there's no way we're moving anything today. It's just getting information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the record, I'm Shelley Hughes, represent the Greater Palmer area. Thank you for hearing my bill today, and I'm inviting up my Chief of Staff, Ginger Plaisdale, with permission of the Chair, as she can answer some of the technical questions. This was a bill that we worked on the prior legislative session, and we believe we're coming back with an improvement, and it primarily, my desire is to protect seniors and people that are at vulnerable stages of their life. And we are all aware that there's often, on occasion, there's fraud and abuse that occurs in power of attorney relationships. And there are some needed clarifications and strengthening to protect seniors and those that might need to have someone take care of matters for them, and so that is that's the purpose of this legislation. In my area, we have one of the fastest growing senior communities, and so my constituents are very interested and supportive in this piece of legislation, and we've heard from senior groups across the state. Alaska Commission on Aging is supportive, AARP is supportive, and we've also heard from a newer senior group, the Association of Mature American Citizens, is also supportive. So in general, what we're going to do is there's some technical cleanup, even in language that we use. The word agent will, or the word principal, we refer to the person granting the power. The word agent is the person being granted the power, and it cleans up the form, makes the form that is signed much more user-friendly and understandable, and so that the senior or the person who is signing it goes through the steps, knows exactly what powers they are granting and what powers they are withholding. There's actually a section of what's called hot powers, which are the ones that are important that a person really think long and hard before they grant those powers, and Ginger will talk about those. One of the things, not only do we want the life for those that are vulnerable to be better and for them not to be taken advantage of, but we want fewer investigations, lawsuits, court proceedings that focus around that. And if talking to those in the legal community, because of the lack of clarification, it has been something that we see going through the courts. It's also something the ombudsman sees coming to their office. It's also something, as a legislator, I've seen come to my office, problems with constituents, and we believe that this bill will reduce that. I think that those are my general overview comments, and Mr. Chair, with your permission, Ginger can walk us through the bill and give some particulars, and we can answer questions. We have lifelines here also, in case we get into something that is quite technical. So,
Representative Neil Foster has joined us. And I'm going to ask the committee if they have any questions on the general overview first, And then when Ginger starts, what we'll try to do, Ginger, is not interrupt you. So I just encourage the committee, if you have a question, try to just catalog it where you're at, then we can go back to it. But if you want us to ask questions, I'll leave that up to you. But it's more important that we get the overall picture. That's why we take that approach. Representative Hughes.
There is one other general overview thing that I neglected to mention. I'd like to bring it up before she begins. Is that one of the purposes, too, that we wanted to do, because we do live in a mobile society, and we're in and out of Alaska. It's wonderful we have the older generation often staying here, but sometimes it involves a child who may be a power of attorney moves across state lines. We went through to look at how it would work if we have a state border separating. We did not accept everything fully as far as the uniform code, but we did look at those things that made sense for Alaska to make it better and for both the principal and the agent. I know for myself, I might find myself in one or the other role sometime.
Oh, we're going to take it at ease. On the record for just a moment here, there's going to be about a 5-minute delay here where we check to see what's recorded, what isn't, and then we'll be back on. So it's I'm showing about 1:14.
Actually, she says she's back on.
You're
it's
back
working
on? Yeah, okay, we're getting checked. Is it working back there? Okay, we're up and running. We'll just stay right on and keep stumbling along, trying to pick up the pieces. I think everything Representative Hughes that you've said is on the record. And if we learn otherwise, you may want to give another overview. But anyway, before we go there, Representative Lynn has a question on the overview.
Yes, thank you for your comments. Is there a legal definition of what is a senior? I know sometimes, you know, it's one thing at a restaurant, another thing for this, for that. Is there a legal definition? Who is a legal senior or such a thing?
I would need a lifeline for that. I do not know offhand, other than age 65 and up.
Through the record, this is Ginger Blaisdell, staff to Representative Hughes. This document may not necessarily only be for seniors. We tend to use it more when we start to get older because we realize that we might be in a circumstance where somebody needs to take powers, you know, take care of our financial responsibilities. But this also might be for someone who is going into surgery. Maybe they have a cancer treatment that they know is going to take a couple months, and they want someone to handle all of their financial affairs. It could be anyone of any age who wants someone to take care of their finances.
Yeah, through the chair. Yeah, okay, I understand that. But where the word senior may be used somewhere in this document here, is there a definition? And we'll get back with you.
I don't think it's in the document.
Okay, we can... Yeah. We can watch for it as we go. Representative Grunberg.
Are we going to have somebody here from the Uniform Commissioners? They're on the line, or they will be?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg. Deborah Bear is part of the, she is one of the commissioners from the Uniform Law Commission.
You don't have somebody from the staff in Chicago?
Not anybody from Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So with Matt, this is on the general overview and where we're going. We haven't even gone to the bill, so
right.
Don't get specific, or I'll, you know.
No. I just want to make the kind of where we are in Alaska. We enacted the Uniform Probate Code in the 60s, which had a power of attorney provisions in it. Is that correct? May have been in the 70s.
We enacted it in 72.
Representative Grunberg, go through the chair. We don't want we want to keep it in order. And if I don't, there's somebody in the room that'll, you know, hit me. So it just keeps the order. Matt, you had a question standing on the floor here for the sponsor.
Through the chair, it was in 1972.
All right. Thank you. Just a couple of follow-ups. And so, as I understand it, what has occurred is a product of the Uniform Laws Commission and other discussions in this state and other states. There was recognition that all states really needed to update their probate code as to powers of attorney. And this is really an effort, as what we hope is going on in all 50 states, to update the Powers of Attorney Act to be consistent with what's on a national level been perceived to be best practices.
Well, I would say yes and no, because we went through the chair. We did go through the items one by one and included those that made sense, but we did not adopt all the recommendations, and therefore the Uniform Law Commission did not provide a letter of support for our bill. But it does definitely improve the ability to work across state lines.
And just last,
Representative Clayman,
hopefully
you have a follow-up.
Yes, one last one, which I hope in your more detailed provisions in summary, will you be identifying the areas in which your recommendation is to not follow the Uniform Laws Commission's recommendation, if that question makes sense?
Through the chair, we can point out some of those as Ginger recalls that. We went through that process a lot last year, so we will do our best to try to point out where we were in alignment and what we didn't adopt.
Okay. So that's good. That helps us on the overview. That gives us something to watch for and appreciate it. Now, is this got to be a general question? Representative Grunberg, go ahead.
I'm sort of asking you, Representative Ginger and Deborah Baer, too. Back of the room. I think it would be helpful to me at some point, sooner rather than later, that we get somebody from the staff of the Uniform Commissioners in Chicago to be able to be involved. Not today. I'm not trying to delay this. I'm saying at some point, and I'm going to give you just one example, because they have a new definition of state.
Representative Grunberg, we're not going to go there, because what we haven't, we got to get the bill in front of us first. And your comment, though, is well taken, and I'm sure we'll go there. But let's not give examples, and let's get a picture of the bill here first. So we'll go back to the sponsor.
And Kane, with that, I will let Ginger start walking us through the bill.
Okay, thanks. And again, respectfully, committee members, try to jot down the page, the line number, where the question is at, and I will, you know, give you as long as I can before we get into HB 79 to get any questions that we want to explore on this on the table. So go ahead, Ginger.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Okay. So Section 1. Section 1 begins with a definition of agent, just describing that is the person who would be receiving any of the powers authorized to them by the principal. And the old term used to be attorney in fact, and that's just an old term that typically is not used any longer. So agent really brings it into more current language. Section 2 includes the U.S. states, Virgin Islands, and that's, I think we've seen that in a lot of pieces of legislation in the last few years, where it's almost more like a revisor's change. So we're bringing the Virgin Islands into the group as well.
Please proceed. I was just going to flag that section. I just wanted to say.
You can do that on your own.
Okay.
Yeah, some I will, yeah. Section 3 is, that one is adding definitions. And the one that's most important in this definition stack is an item that was brought to us by one of the senior homes here in Alaska. And they wanted us to really clarify the definition of signing, so to sign a document. They had some individuals who might be incapacitated because of a stroke where they were not able to actually physically sign something, might have severe arthritis, but still mentally certainly capable to make decisions on their own behalf. And so the definition of sign now includes an electronic signature. So if they can do a voice approval or denial of an action, it could be an X if somebody, you know, if they want to actually sign a document. If it's an X and somebody says, yes, that is the person and that is their signature at the time, there's a variety of ways that they can sign it, or they might ask someone to sign on their behalf. So that really allowed our citizens to be able to sign a document in the best way they could. Section 4, again, is really talking about the agent, and then it also, I'm trying to think the best way to talk about this. It talks about the agent's acceptance and what they're liable for. So the agent is going to receive those powers, and by doing so, they are going to be conducting themselves honestly and on the best, in the best behalf of the principal who's awarding them those. Talks about the agent's duties. So again, it's asking them to act in good faith. It's asking them to be loyal to the principal, acting with care, keep a record of all the receipts that they're doing, and really trying to preserve their estate if that's part of their plan, and really caring for their finances as if they were the principal. Section 4 is, I'm still on Section 4. Section 4 is very long. Sorry. Acceptance of the power of attorney, which is on page 4 and starts on line 22. This pertains to a third party accepting the responsibilities of an agent. A principal might want their accounting firm. They might want their family attorney. They might want another individual to actually act as their agent on behalf of all their financial concerns. And could actually be a court-appointed person like a conservator. Page 6 starts the termination of a power of attorney. And it recognizes that if an agent were to resign, on the form power of attorney, you can put a second designee. So if you know somebody might not be able to conduct all of your financial affairs, it could automatically roll to a next person if that person were to resign. Otherwise, it tends to go to a probate court, and you might have a conservator signed on your behalf, and then that would then become, in essence, the power of attorney. Section 5 is at the top of page 7, and the validity of the power of attorney executed in another state says that in Alaska, we are going to generally accept someone else's power of attorney if it were adopted in another state or followed the, it was executed in another state, and it's that state-approved document. So if you're writing something on the back of a napkin, it probably isn't going to work. Mm-hmm. But if you're filling out, you know, that state's power of attorney form, it would be generally accepted here in Alaska. Section 6 is actually the form, the statutory form power of attorney. And this form is identified in statute, and it comes with specific instructions. One of the instructions that has changed is, again, at the request of, I think this one actually may have come from the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. And what we changed is that prior, if someone wanted to sign the power of attorney form, you could just have one signature at the bottom, and you basically enacted everything on the list, unless you specifically went and crossed out something. So you'd have to draw a line through the whole item. And now what we've done is actually made it a yes-no box selection, so you would check off a yes or a no. And it, what it will do is it will have the person who is describing the power of attorney form to the individual, or maybe that individual can understand it on their own. But they actually go through and select each power, and they understand, hopefully, a little better, really what they're giving away. So, for example, if I wanted somebody to manage my household effects and pay my utility bills, I can go through and say a real estate transaction, that might be it. Banking transactions, yes. Maybe my estate transactions. I can choose which ones I want for that person to manage. And I can select no if I don't want them to deal with my retirement account or if I don't want them to deal with my voter registration or anything like that. You can select no on some things. You could also have more than one power of attorney. If you had one person you wanted to take care of your household effects, your day-to-day finances, and if you had another person you wanted to do some of the other parts of business. So now hopefully they'll have a better understanding of each item that they're actually giving away. And then on page 9 is it's a new section. It's called a grant of specific authority, and you'll see it also has on there the word optional. This is not a requirement for anyone to select those items, and so you'll see there is no yes, no, because the whole thing is optional. If you don't select it, it's automatically no. The hot powers are maybe a much more broad and kind of a more impactful financial transaction that you would do. So the first one is create, amend, revoke, or terminate a trust. And so that's a fairly significant responsibility that someone may or may not want to give their power of attorney or their agent. Making a gift, and a gift is very broad. It could be buying a raffle ticket for a student who's coming through looking for $10. Or it could be a gift to a charity of many thousands of dollars. So it could be a gift, and it could be a gift to another family member or to themselves. So a gift is quite broad. Changing a beneficiary designation, that's a very significant item that a principal may or may not award to their power of attorney. And there are 4 other items that were requested from the Uniform Law Commission, and truly, I don't know why we didn't get all 8 items in, but one of the recommendations would be to add those other items. And that is one of the things that was not adopted in this version of the bill from the Uniform Law Code. And certainly we'd be happy to entertain those few items.
Mr. Chair, this is Shelley Hughes. I just want to say we had actually wanted all 8 items in there, and so it was one of those things that was just, it fell through the cracks accidentally in the drafting. So I just wanted to clarify that. So
yes. You want it in?
Yes. Okay. So continuing on page 9, one of the other things is that we say to mark instead of check, because somebody may not actually put a check mark, you know, that looks like a check. A mark can be any kind of mark that person might be able to make. So a very slight term change, but we felt that was that was important since we were changing the definition of to sign a document. And the other thing that also has changed is the word incapacity compared to disability. In the definition section, I'll talk about what incapacity means, but it does not mean that you have to be disabled to be incapacitated. So. Okay. And then if I can just draw your attention to the bottom of page 11 and the top of page 12. At the bottom, this is an additional provision. It's an optional provision for power of for the statutory form. And item number 3, which is line 31, says you may nominate a guardian or, and at the top it says conservator. And one thing that was asked of us is the exact definition of guardian and conservator. And we don't have that specific definition in the statute. And so that might be a recommendation if we say, you know, a guardian as defined in AS, wherever it might be defined, or we might need to add an actual definition. That's one item that was brought to us by the Alaska Commission on Aging when we were walking through the bill with them. So we might need to clarify that definition.
Mr. Chair?
Like I say, I would really rather get the big picture.
Right, I'm just trying to get that. I couldn't find the place on the page because I was.
Okay, I'm sorry. Page 12. Oh. And the bottom of line, page 11, where it says you may nominate a guardian, the last second to last word on page 11, or conservator, first word on page 12. Please continue.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I couldn't hear Ginger. Would you mind repeating this last thing? Would you? I just couldn't hear you.
Yes, we were asked to better clarify the definition of guardian and conservator. They may be defined somewhere in statute, and we just need to put that reference in the bill, or we need to add that as a definition in the bill. And so that was a request made of us. It does not show in this bill at this time.
For the record, that is, those terms are defined in the code.
Representative Grunberg, what we just want to keep, let them have the floor unless they ask for questions. And please just mark it. If you don't hear it, leave yourself a tab, and we'll go back to it. We repeat it at the time.
All right.
Go ahead, Ginger.
All right. Thank you. Section 8 is on page 12, and what we're changing here is updating the terminology again. So we're using the word agent and mark rather than attorney in fact or check. A couple places in the bill you might see the removal of the words revoke, create, or modify a trust, and that's because we moved that to be a hot power rather than having that throughout the general ability of a power of the agent to be able to do. So like at the top of page 13, you'll see revoke, create, or modify a trust is being removed, and that's because, again, it was added to a hot power. And that's the same changes on page 14, same on page 15, 16. A lot of these are the same where we're removing things where we've put them in another place. Mm. On page 19, we've added the ability for the agent to use credit, debit cards, and electronic transaction authorizations. This is certainly bringing us current into the time since we have so many auto pay and so many things that are already set up through our credit card and electronic payments. All right, section 13 is adding additional responsibilities of the agent or to the agent to manage the principal's affairs. So item number 10, which is on page 19, item number 10 allows the agent to operate, buy, sell, or whatever the principal's interest in a business. 11 allows them to put additional capital into a business.
23.
Oh, 23. Am I on the wrong spot? Oh, thank you, yes. 13 is to sell or liquidate the business. And 14 is to establish the value under a buyout agreement.
Ginger,
yes.
Put us back up a little bit here. Where are these items 10 through 15?
On the bottom, or at the top of page 23. Sorry, I got my numbers all mixed up here.
Okay, if you would just kind of back up a little bit, mm-hmm. and tell us what those are. And
yeah, so beginning on line 4, those items are all in relation to an agent's ability to manage the principal's business affairs. And those weren't clearly identified before. These are items that were taken from the Uniform Code, and it just clarifies additional actions that they can do in managing business affairs of the principal. So they can operate, buy, sell the principal's interest in a business. They can put additional capital into the business. They can participate in the reorganization, sell or liquidate the business, or establish the value under a buyout agreement. So it does give them a lot more power to manage someone's business. Page 25, item 13, is kind of in the center of the page. It identifies an additional function of managing the principal's insurance or annuity. And so this one allows the agent to exercise investment powers. And, again, that was something that had not been identified before this change. Section 16 is regarding personal relationships of the principal and what the agent would be responsible to do. Oh, I skipped 15. Oops, sorry. I skipped section 15. Okay, so this one, let me see exactly how it's written here. Okay, so section 15 used to be a section about the agent's ability to give gifts. That one is repealed. It's reenacted, and it's talking more about the instructions regarding the principal's retirement plans. Part of what we did between last year's version of the bill and this year's version of the bill is we reorganized the structure of it. Last year we had a lot of problems going from a section on the form to a section in the bill, and it kind of bounced around and it was not very free-flowing. This year it actually goes in a more linear pattern, so you can actually walk down the form itself and follow the statutes, and it really better defines what all of those responsibilities are. And so that's what that repeal the repeal and reenact. It's a section that was there, just in a different area. All right, section 16, regarding the principal's relationships, really has to do more with maybe adopted children, maybe child support. It has to do with personal relationships that have a financial responsibility tied to them in some way. This power of attorney is strictly for financial matters. It is not your health power of attorney. It is not any other, it doesn't grant you those kinds of powers. So section 16 is dealing with the financial obligations and of personal relationships. Also deals with HIPAA. So you do have a HIPAA requirement. The bottom of page 28, it identifies that so you can act as the principal's agent if you need to sign a HIPAA form or deal with that. Section 17, primarily on page 29, is regarding to government, civil, or military service. And the civil service is going to be like someone who works for the Department of State. They may be doing civil service. They may not be doing an actual military billet somewhere. And this is dealing with transportation of the individual's household effects. It's dealing with all the financial issues with military. Section 18 is, this is an optional designation. This is one of the hot powers, and it's regarding gift giving. That's the one that was repealed in the other one and reinstated with a different section. So Section 18 talks about how gift giving is
just take a pause.
Be awarded. Mm-hmm.
Just one question. You've made a couple or three references to the hot powers.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what that means? Because I'm a little lost, and it'll help me understand what you meant.
That's a good overview type thing, so we all are thinking the same thing. But you're referring back to the powers that were listed in what, section what, early on, right?
Yes.
Number.
Yes, certainly. Through the chair, Representative Klayman. Hot powers is a user term that I actually learned from the Uniform Law Commission. The hot powers is something that is independently chosen. It's not part of a form, and it otherwise would not be awarded to the agent. And so it has to be specifically selected. On the form, it's that section that says optional.
Check or mark the box.
Yes.
The sponsor?
And through the chair, they're very substantial. You're giving some pretty hefty power in those kind of things, creating or revoking a trust, changing a beneficiary. They're something that it's important that the principal consider very seriously and not take lightly. So they're put in a separate section.
I'm going to insert here Representative Klayman and Representative Grunberg, because I don't want any misunderstanding. Is that I'm trying something a little different, you know, and I think it's working. I mean, it helps me anyway to get a big overview picture, and if we don't interrupt, and you're not, I mean, appreciate that. It's helpful to get a question that has to helps us get the picture of what's going on. That I'm not disagreeing at that. I'm saying
right,
that's
no,
a good question, but if you're, yeah, that's just trying to explain, put on yeah. the record what I'm doing. So
I understood that there were all these additional powers they had to choose, but I had somewhere in the course I kind of missed that those were, quote, hot powers.
Okay.
So
okay.
I need a little clarity, but that gave it to me, and now I understand.
Okay.
I have a question about
proceed,
that.
Yeah.
No.
Oh. About that. I didn't hear that until I said, okay,
well, you're doing a good job.
No, thanks. Yeah. Please proceed.
Thank you. Yeah, actually, hot powers is just jargon. So, and actually, I'll just kind of read a little bit of Section 18 to give you the kind of the understanding of how important the hot powers are, the optional award. So, like, and as it references to a gift, so when you're filling out that form, if you would actually read the statute of what it means to give gift powers, it says to make a gift of the principal's property only as the agent determines it's consistent with the principal's objectives. So hopefully they know the principal well enough that they know what their objective would be. So it might be the value and nature of the principal's property. It might be their foreseeable obligations. Minimization of taxes, including income, estate, inheritance, generation skipping, transfer, gift taxes. There's a lot of details that go into this. Eligibility for a benefit, the principal's personal history of making or joining, you know, making gifts. So if they always gave a scholarship fund, you know, $10,000 a year, that might be an appropriate gift for them to continue giving that. If they never spent a dime and suddenly the agent says, yahoo, I have a checkbook, you know, that might not be consistent with how the statute is asking that agent to behave when they're giving gifts. So there are some specific rules on what it means to give gifts. Okay. Section 19 talks about to relieve an agent of liability for breach of duty unless it was committed dishonestly. And what this one does is at the very bottom, where number 4, at the bottom of page 31, line 29, it relieves an agent of liability for breach of duty. That sounds almost opposite of what's happening. Because an agent is liable for what they're doing. They took on that responsibility, and they need to behave in an honest fashion when they're dealing with someone else's finances. But it's relieving them of liability of breach if they, say, were accidentally late on a utility payment. They aren't going to be taken to court by another family member because they got a $5 late fee. For the most part, they want them to act as well as possible in managing the principal's financial affairs. But if they're acting dishonestly with improper motive, you know, if they're not behaving correctly, then there is an opportunity to have them relieved of their duty. So it looks a little bit opposite of what it sounds like, but I think it is an appropriate action. Section 20 is replacing disability or incompetence to the term incapacity, and then again, replacing agent. And we'll get to the definition of incapacity here soon. Section 21, repeal and reenacted. Again, this is an organizational structure where it's repealed and reenacted. But this clarifies the grounds for determining incapacity of an individual. And it includes things, so incapacity means if you are impaired somehow, where you can't evaluate the what's happening with the power of attorney. It's not whether you can physically sign it or not, which would be more of a disability, but it's if you can't comprehend what you're doing. And it also includes if you're missing, if you're detained, if you've been incarcerated, or if you're outside the United States and unable to return. So incapacity does not mean, like senior, how we kind of talked about before. It doesn't mean that you are disabled or incompetent. It just means that you don't have the ability to evaluate the information and comprehend what you're doing. Or you're physically not there. Okay. Section 22 is a technical amendment updating the statutory references. Section 23, which is on page 34, adds a new section. One of them is judicial relief. So it talks about petitioning a court to talk about the power of attorney and possibly review the agent's conduct. So there could be an issue where another family member says, oh, I think the agent is acting inappropriately because suddenly grandma, who hasn't been able to drive for 3 years, has a new car. So it allows you to actually bring those types of items in question to court. And then on line 23, relationship to other laws. So it does talk about some of the remedies. It does talk about other laws that it is related to. Section 24 is at the top of page 35. And this one is just all the term changes again. Incapacity, agent. It's just inserting the correct terms. Section 25, also a technical amendment. Section 26 adds new definitions. We do have a couple of sections that talk about acting in good faith on behalf of another person, and that's basically meaning to be honest. Incapacity, we talked about the definition of incapacity. We added a retirement plan, and that talks about all the variety of retirement plans that a person might be responsible for. So adding these new definitions were important. And then starting at the bottom of page 36, section 27, is adding a new chapter. And this is a completely new section that was added from last year. This is a uniform law. And we did take it pretty much word for word from the Uniform Law Commission. This is recognition of substitute decision-making documents. What this does is, I'll just give you sort of a made-up scenario. My mother lives with me, and I'm her power of attorney. I take care of her. And because she doesn't want to deal with her finances anymore. And she's going to visit my brother in Colorado for a month or two. I may want to have a substitute decision-making document signed that says my powers are, the powers of attorney are going to be accepted in the state of Colorado. So when she's down there, or maybe I award powers to my brother, the state of Colorado. So if she's down there and has a stroke, he can make decisions or handle her financial affairs while she's down there. Everything applies between states. There were a few examples of where when you cross a state line, certain powers are accepted, certain aren't, and it could take months or days before some kinds of financial decisions can be made. And so that was important to be able to pass that on to another state. some of this is... It's adding all new language, but it's very similar to the powers of attorney. It's allowing electronic signatures, the definitions, again, good faith, health care, person. So it's going to talk about some of those definitions again, obligation to accept the decision-making document. You're not required to accept it, but it might be on your best interest to accept it even if for the short term. And so the short title, this one actually says cited as the Uniform Recognition and Substitute Decision-Making Documents Act. That one is because it is pretty much word for word right from the Uniform Law Commission. Our power of attorney does not say uniform, and that's because we did make some changes where it does not match exactly. And Chairman Keller, that is a quick rundown of every section of a 40-page bill.
Yeah, and that's why you need senior staff around. Good job, Ginger. You did a really good job. And we're going to that was helpful for me to get the big picture, and now we'll just open it up to the committee for specifics. Representative Grunberg.
Just very briefly, and I owe you an apology. I'm working on this thing as we talk about. It's going to be helpful to me at some point to either get a document or some testimony from the staff of the uniform commissioners the difference between this and the Uniform Act. And I am aware that some of these uniform acts, like the Uniform Probate Code, are so big and complex that they don't even list in the Uniform Acts annotated all the differences between the states. There are just too many. But when we're doing that, I'd like to know such things as when these were promulgated, these two bills and stuff. But I want to reserve those for the staff, really.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I have word for word every section compared the Uniform Code, Alaska, and some notes that the Uniform Law Commission made. Oh. And I didn't put it in this packet because it's huge, and last year when I included it in the packet, nobody really
did you give that to me already?
Yes, last year. Yeah.
Well,
that's okay.
If what we could do is let Representative Grunberg work with the sponsor on this, and then your request is, I think, noted.
I think she's probably fulfilled it along with everything else I'm remiss around.
Okay.
Yeah.
Next question.
I'm happy to provide it to the committee if you want the whole document of what we accepted and did not accept straight across. Or
if you don't mind, if you would give that to Tom, and then Tom can distribute it as the chair wishes. I'm the substitute, so we'll. We'll let Tom handle that. Next question. Anyone?
Question
Matt?
That
Representative
relates to Representative Grunberg's question. And I think Ms. Baer from the Uniform Law Commission, or a commissioner on the Commission for Uniform Laws is here. My understanding is that the Uniform Law Commission chose not to endorse our proposed amendments. Would Ms. Baer be available to explain the reasons why the Commission didn't endorse what we've done and the specific areas in which they differ, or is that something we should get in writing in the future?
Yeah, we won't do that now, but that's, again, duly noted with Representative Grunberg's. Yeah, and along with that, if you concur, is also back to the items that were left out by Ledge Legal. I would like to know why they were left out, if there's a reason that Ledge Legal decided not to include them, or if it was a typo or what, so we have a better understanding of
right.
What those issues are.
Because on that, and I'm not sure if you'd want to take it up today, but I would like to get some detailed analysis about where, because I may be incorrect in my assumption, but the Uniform Laws Commission, some areas they didn't have any problem with the changes, and in certain other areas they probably did. And I'm more interested in the areas in which they have differences with us and the reasons why.
And what would be helpful for future meetings is that if you get together with a sponsor, and I try to identify those spots before we get there. What we're doing today is just trying to get the questions on the table.
Right.
We're not going to get it all answered, of course. Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Chair, sometimes if I may make a suggestion. As you will recall from the days you were chair, it's sometimes helpful to have a working group so we don't have to bother other people and we don't have to confine ourselves to the time the committee meets. And those of us who are interested can get together here or wherever is appropriate. And I'm certainly very willing to do that. and maybe I'm out of line in suggesting that that might speed the process.
Not a line, just not a question, and I'm sure it's duly noted by the staff of the Judiciary Committee, and that offer will go, I'm sure.
And I do have one question.
Yeah, sure.
It sounded to me like you folks were looking at this power of attorney as a financial power of attorney. In family law, we used powers of attorneys all the time to give, let's say you didn't want to have a custody change and you wanted to do it informally, they could simply fill out a form, and there was a, it's in Title IX, so I have to find it, that would give whoever it is power of the parent for a period of time, up to a year, and you could just renew it. But let's say a parents moved across the bay or something like my parents did at one point, give it to my grandmother so that I could live with her. But it sounds like you didn't go there. Are you leaving those other kinds of powers of attorney as is? You are.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we are not entering into those powers. This is strictly a financial powers document.
And one more question, if I may.
Follow up, Representative Grunberg.
The Uniform Act is limited accordingly.
Through the chair, yes, it is. Yes.
Okay.
And Chairman Keller, if I can just quickly address Representative Klayman's remarks.
Sure.
When we first started looking at this, we were asked by a number of agents who deal with people who have had fraud happen to. In this state, it tended to be fraud happening more toward seniors or elderly parents, particularly. And so when we got ready to draft this, what I did is I had contacted the Uniform Law Commission, and I asked them if they could give me some kind of comparison between Alaska's existing powers of attorney laws and the Uniform Code Model Act. And so the Uniform Law Commission did create this document that I was flashing before you, and they did a nice comparison. They had an intern for the summer who spent about 2 months working on this, comparing every statute. When we brought that document, when I got the document, I sat down with the long-term care ombudsman and their attorney, and we went through every single line, section by section, compared. And we found that while some of the language that the Uniform Law Commission was requesting in Alaska statute where it already existed, it was similar enough that we felt we didn't need to change it. And then we do have some very specific Alaska laws that pertain to Native rights, you know, some of, like a shareholder or some of those Native corporation rights. We didn't want to change those. Those are specific to Alaska. The Uniform Law Commission has not spoken to me directly about which sections they really felt were not following what their desire was. So I can't tell you which ones might be less impactful than others. There are a couple of items, though, if I can just bring them up, that I know that maybe the committee would like us to address. One of them I brought out was that we knew we had put four of the hot powers in the form, and we just missed that there were actually eight, and so we're looking to add the others. So that might be something that you would agree we could put into a CS. Another item was to clarify the definitions. One of them was guardian, one was conservator, and on page 35, line 24, there's also a generic term that's called a public home care provider. And we wanted to make sure that we have a good definition of what that really means.
Okay, on page 35, and you said
page
section 24?
Page 35, line 24.
Line 24.
Line okay. 24, yes.
A public home care provider. And you're suggesting that the committee look at whether or not there should be a definition included.
That, correct. Yeah. We might need to define that a little more clearly.
What's the line again?
Page 35, line 24, mm-hmm. Sub A, and the words that are in question are what is a public home care provider? You know.
Right. And just to clearly define what that is, it has been in our statute before. What we're doing is just correcting the attorney in fact language. But what that really means is that if you are, say, a PCA, personal care attendant, and you go into the person's home and you're taking care of their maybe their medical needs, maybe it's balancing their checkbook, they get to do a lot of different skills to help someone still live at home. What this statute says is that that person should not be your power of attorney, because you're being paid to do a certain set of skills. They don't want you to also be the power of attorney, because that would might create a conflict of interest as far as the well-being of the principal. So we're just, but we do need to have a better definition of that public home care provider. Two other questions that may or may not need clarification is, again, on page 35, and on line 20, it said a special power of attorney created before September 4, 1988. And I just have to plead ignorance, because I don't know what happened on September 4th, 1988, that one is so significant to stay in statute. So I need to research that a little bit further, but I was asked to clarify that in a different meeting earlier this week.
Probably the day after Labor Day.
It may have been.
I understand it was a full.
No, wait. Yeah. The recorder gets really frustrated with us when we get these kind of comments going across the ceiling, and both you, Representative Klayman, and you, Representative Grunberg, were out of line.
You're right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I just said maybe it was a full moon.
Representative Grunberg, I believe me, I understand the urge. I do the same thing in other committees, so it isn't that I'm just trying to make it easy on everybody. Is there another question?
Yes.
Representative Grunberg?
We are dealing with another bill, and it was House Bill 15. It dealt with conservator. And deal number five, House Bill 5, dealing with conservators and conflicts of interest. And we have, my office and I have been extensively researching this. I'm delighted to talk with you about this. And I've just been on the phone a few minutes ago with the staff of the Uniform Commissioners figuring out why this kind of language appears. But I just want you to know that I'm sensitive on that.
Okay. Hey, Representative Klayman?
Try to make this my last question so we can get on.
No, I'm not trying to push. The questions are very helpful now at this stage. So
the one of the major global changes that's going on in the statute is switching from the use of the term disability to the term incapacity. And is that a change that's recommended by the uniform laws? And if so, why?
Just a moment. Let me look that one up real quick here.
Oh. Mr. Chair, may I interject something here?
Let's just wait, because that'll confuse it. But I'll go right to you right after.
Sure. May I have the final status of bills and resolutions from my shelf, please, for the last legislature?
Ginger?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman. I would have to go through this large document from the Uniform Law Commission to make sure. But one of the items that I did flag in existing statute is there's a note to decision. It's on AS 1326. 10, and it is talking about the definition of an incapacitated person, and so it's a court decision that was made, and I think that's really what drove the definition change. I spoke with so many people on what changes they all wanted. I can't confirm if it was actually in this document or if we went because it was a legal note, and it may have been a recommendation by the Ledge Legal Services.
If you can get back to me on that, that'd be
mm-hmm. I certainly will.
I have a couple remedial level, maybe re-explanations here.
remedial in the sense that I'm just trying to get my head around them. One is, I think you referred to a section here that talks about the validity of the power of attorney. It's on page 7, I should say, right at the top, validity of the power of attorney in another state. And it occurred to me, as you said growing sophistication, I guess, of our powers of attorney may, in fact, harm some also. If people that don't understand, people that do fill out on a napkin trying to get their last wishes out there. And that got me to think about this further, and I'm going to invite your feedback on this. And as you go through the box, check off, this counts, this doesn't. I'm wondering, and as I understood it, there's two categories of power of attorney that are optional here, that option here. Does the uniform code or does anybody go to different levels of power of attorney beyond that, like maybe having a power of attorney for business, a power of attorney for, this breakdown, if we get it too confusing, it's going to end up hurting people because they won't do it because they can't understand it. It's kind of a broad question, but I just wondered if that had occurred either to the sponsor or to you, Ginger, as you were working on this. If are we really gaining here, by getting precise?
Thank you for the question, Chair Keller. I think that we really feel like ultimately that it's making the form more user-friendly and more understandable for the person filling it out, the way it breaks it apart, and because they have to stop and think about each thing. And often a person is filling that out sometimes with the assistance of an attorney where they could ask. So I think that the purpose was to simplify it and make it more user-friendly, and I'll let Ginger comment, and that was the feedback, too, as far as when the need came before us, that was part of the purpose of what we're doing here. So I understand what we don't want to make it more harmful, and we want to abide by the wishes of the principal, and I believe it achieves it better than what we currently have.
Chairman Keller, I can share with you a personal experience, because I also just walked through powers of attorney with my parents. And we actually ended up completing, I think, 4 or 5 different kinds of forms. One was a will. A will takes place after the person dies. One's a power of attorney for health care decisions. One was a financial power of attorney. The health care decisions, the financial power of attorney, are powers that are granted while the person is still living. So you could have somebody managing all of your financial effects while you're alive, and when you die, somebody else might take over a completely different arena, or might disperse the funds differently, or so there might be a completely different action. So it really depends on what phase of life you're in, and what expectations you want or have. And so there are a variety of different powers of attorney. Some of them can be very short-term. We filled out powers of attorney for coaches when they traveled with my son when he would leave the country to go to Canada and play hockey. That lasted for, 72 hours, and darn, he came back, So, so there's such a wide variety of powers that you can award. This particular document is strictly dealing with the financial responsibilities of a person when they become incapacitated. So if they are not able to fulfill their financial obligations, someone else is in place ready to do so.
That really helps. I was trying to make it fit too many different places, and that helps for me to understand. So I'm glad I asked the dumb question. So it's something that is filled out to prevent a problem if there's an incapacity, or is it? Yeah, it has to be, because in other words, it'd be a preventative type thing. What comes to my mind is something I'm sure you'll hear from me in the future in this committee. But if it wasn't for attorneys, we wouldn't need them. It gets so complex.
That's a great quote.
Representative Grunberg.
In response to what Representative Klayman was just asking, you might take a look at two laws we just passed last year. One, and they're both by Representative Millett. One was House Bill 88, which was codified as Chapter 42, SLA 2013. And the other was House Bill 211, which was codified as Chapter 19, SLA 2014. And one dealt with statutory reference to metal retardation and using more up-to-date terms. And the other dealt with the employment of persons with disabilities. And I know this was a fairly sensitive and important issue to people with certain disabilities or capacities, and how those would fit in with the terms you're using here ought to be looked at, because the Uniform Act is drafted nationally, and other states haven't gone through the same history we did in the last couple of years, and I'm sure Representative Millett would be saying the same thing if she were present today.
Any other questions?
Through the chair.
Did you want to respond?
Yes, please.
Hughes?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we will look at that, and thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Just to follow up, because I didn't write it. That I did not write down. There was a section, Ginger, that you referenced about my question about incapacity versus disability. What code section was that? It was tabbed in your book.
This tab. 1326.10, was it?
Yes, 1326.10. And it's the court notes to decisions.
The case note.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask you to repeat, and this is old age and me catching up, but if you would go back to page 8 and just give me the real briefly again. What I'm trying to get through my head is what are the hot powers and how they really relate, because I hadn't thought that through until after the fact, and so going back, I'm having a hard time meshing, and I'm assuming that you're going to give us the whole list and we'll be able to compare them better, but you know, where did the list come from on page 8? That's existing law, where we just added the no column to make it a different process. And what are those not hot powers then?
Yes, Chairman Keller. On page 8 is a list of, I'm just going to call them routine financial transactions that probably most individuals deal with on a regular basis. And that's going to deal with your investments, it's going to deal with your bank account, your household effects, utility payments. It's going to deal with some of your personal relationships and affairs, so like child support payments, those kinds of things. This list already existed, and it's, for the most part, been kept the same. We removed gift transactions. We did add retirement plans as a separate item. And when you turn to page 9, it says grant of specific authority. And so that's the jargon that we've been using called hot powers. So the grant of specific authority is strictly optional. And that's where you can change a trust, you can give gifts, you can change beneficiaries. These are all much more substantial, and this is where an agent could actually probably commit the greatest level of fraud by giving themselves a gift, changing their beneficiary designation so maybe they get everything in the end, that kind of thing. The Uniform Law Commission asked for the other four added. Let me see if they outlined them real quick.
That's all right. If you can't find it, I'm sure we'll be back to this section. I asked you to do that just because it helps me. I had to get the shelves built first before I could put the information on it, and that helped. Thank you.
Okay. One item that was brought to us on the form that page 8 and 9 is a question that was asked is, what happens if either the yes or no box was not marked in some way? And I haven't gotten an answer back on that, but that is something we may need to do a little bit of clarification in the instructions. So if it's left blank, maybe it's automatically assumed to be a no, just for protection of our seniors or of our incapacitated. So, and the very final note that I would give you is that it has a zero fiscal note. So that's a good thing.
That's the only thing that has a chance around here this time of the year.
Right.
We I'm going to go ahead and give one more opportunity for questions, but we have people that I think maybe got a little short end of the stick on testifying on 79 last time on the marijuana bill. So we want to get to that no later than, let's say, maybe in the next 5 minutes if we can. But
mine's going to take 30 seconds. If you would look on page 9, line 14, I appreciated your having revoking a transfer on death deed. You might want to consider expanding that a bit, because currently you can have transfer on death bank accounts and transfer on death securities accounts. So you'll want to check with Ledge Legal and the folks, and we'll help you on that too. And we are, just a little preview here, we're looking at some legislation that would allow transfer on death titling of vehicles. So you wouldn't have to transfer your car by a will. You just do a little thing that goes to the DMV. So you might want to say something like revoke a transfer on death instrument, because they're not all done under the new chapter, and some of them are done under federal law. We can work on you, with you on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, we're going to put HB8 aside, and thank you to the sponsor and to Ginger. You did a great job, and so set this around aside for future scheduling. We'll bring HB 79 back before us. I think we'll go right online, open public testimony. I don't think it was closed, but we'll just press right on there. How about Pamela Van Hooten? Are you online? And if you've had to wait a long time to testify, we apologize. Just getting everything done sometimes can get confusing. So, Pamela, are you there?
Yes, I am.
If you would, identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, and we're here listening.
Yes, my name is Pamela Van Houten, and I would like to testify concerning HB 79. May I begin?
Yeah. Yes, please, Pamela. That was great. Thank you. Go ahead and give us your testimony.
Okay, thank you. I would like to set forth the concept of public cafes for public consumption of marijuana in the state of Alaska. It would be easy to keep these from public view by darkening the windows, one-way windows, high windows above 7 feet, or to have them in rooms where there are no windows. The reason I believe in the designated public area for consumption is that initially when the bill passed, the Coast Guard stated on the radio that they would prosecute people who were out on marine waters, and they would still consider it illegal. And I see that as setting up a huge area of conflict for the voters who voted for this. And I think to protect the public, to protect tourists, travelers, citizens out on boats, well, so they're not out on boats, and they're not getting ticketed or fined, a safe location that is open, friendly, respectable needs to be designated and encouraged where people can congregate for public use and consumption. And I think by doing that, it minimizes the negative social community impacts. You have people going where you want them to go. People know that's where they're going. You know, they're not off hiding. They're not sneaking around. And I think it eliminates some of the adverse impacts or effects for the community. In addition, just as bartenders are presently required to monitor patrons and their level of inebriation, you know, within the shops or a cafe where they sell it and people are using it, then that could also be put into effect, where there is the cafe owner's responsibility to monitor how just the level, how affected people are, so that they are not, you know, that when they leave, they are ambulatory, you know, they are mobile, they are functioning. So I think that's another positive aspect to having the cafe environment. I think more research needs to be done into the cafe model. It's been successful in Amsterdam and Holland, and if it wasn't successful, I think they would have been closed down. So I think, you know, research needs to be done along with the social positives are, along with the social negatives, so that we can make intelligent choices to guide the public's mandate as they voted in this previous election. Thank you.
Thank you, Pamela.
One more comment, if it's okay.
One more comment, briefly.
Yes, briefly. I think I would like to see the state help to create successful business models for public distribution and usage. So everything is being done responsibly. Thank you.
Thank you. Karen O'Keefe from California.
Good afternoon. I'm Karen O'Keefe. I'm the Director of State Policies at the Marijuana Policy Project from West Hollywood, California. And we've been working to support the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol. We appreciate the committee and staff's hard work to make sure that the criminal statutes of Alaska conform with voters' intent and Measure 2. And the current draft is a dramatic improvement over previous drafts. We're very pleased that the approach that would have just had a simple defense for adults who use marijuana was replaced with an approach of changing, taking marijuana out of the the Controlled Substances Act, and think that that's the way to go, and are very, very grateful for your work. We submitted a memo a few days ago that highlights a few aspects of the bill that we would still recommend changing. And the one that I just wanted to mention briefly in particular was the removal of a phrase that begins each of the protections for both marijuana businesses and for adults that use and possess marijuana, and that's notwithstanding any other provision of law. As I understand it, I know in some cases drafters prefer not to use that phrase, but it is in Alaska statutes in a number of places, and the intention of that phrase is just to make it crystal clear that these protections that were enacted by voters trump anything to the contrary. And since there are so many parts of the statutes in Alaska, it seems possible that something somewhere may inadvertently not have been changed to conform to Measure 2. And so that phrase just makes sure that it's paramount. And also, of course, prior versions of SB 30 and HB 79 themselves included a few things that we think inadvertently weren't in keeping with Measure 2. So that phrase would just make sure that this voter-enacted law trumps. And, you know, if there were a decision to constitutionally make amendments in the future to the provision, then something could be added to say, except as provided in, and then could cite a specific contrary statute. So we're hoping that that phrase will be reinserted, and also there are some other changes we recommended, such as keeping Section 1738.020 for adults protections for possessing, growing, and giving away to others marijuana, and also to make sure that the limits are not reduced in any way. So we're very, very grateful for the committee's work. We know it's in a short time frame, and that's all I have, unless there are any questions.
Karen, thank you. I don't see any questions at this time, but thank you for taking time to call in. John Farley?
Hello.
Yeah, if you would, identify yourself for the record and tell us who you represent and give us your testimony.
Yes, my name is John Farley. I live in Anchorage, Alaska, and I essentially represent myself and my family, and I would like to thank many thinking Alaskans across our beautiful state. I'm a fourth-generation Alaskan. Of course, that doesn't make my opinion any more valuable than anybody else's, but I'm quite familiar with the history of this issue in our state. First, I would like to thank the committee members for considering this legislation. In my view, and in the view of many Alaskans, it's way past time, but better late than never. I'd like to start by reading the final paragraph from an article in today's Anchorage Dispatch News regarding the experience that they have in Colorado. It's a short paragraph. Colorado has implemented a $700 million marijuana market without any of the dire consequences that legalization opponents warned about. Fatal car accidents in the state are flat and well below the past decade average. Crime is down in Denver and the surrounding area. While some societal effects of marijuana legalization may not make themselves fully known until several years down the line, the first year of legal weed in Colorado went smoothly. I would encourage all of the committee members to read that entire article. It's a front page article in today's ADN. I called with, I'm not positive, I'm pretty sure I have a version of the committee substitute that's not the most current version, but I went through the version that I had, and a few concerns popped up.
Just a clarification on that, John, you can go online and go to the committee, and we keep the current version that the committee is working on as soon as we can. We post that online. So.
And for the vast majority of Alaskans, I'm sure that's quite helpful. I might point out that not all of us are very familiar or comfortable using computers. I got this copy from going to the LIO yesterday or Wednesday. I sat through the whole meeting and was one of the few that didn't get to testify on Wednesday.
Well, John, thank you for your patience with us, and the LIO is the right place to go. They would have it, so thanks.
Well, I live in the house I grew up in near the Park Strip here in Anchorage, so I'm in within walking distance of the new building. I want to, my work draft is not all that much different than yours. On mine, on page 17, section 24, AS 1171-900 is amended to read. Whoever drafted this is deleting the sentence, however, the growing of marijuana for personal use is not manufacturing. Now, I'm not sure why that would be removed. It seems to be not appropriate. It seems to me that we should distinguish between someone growing for their own use at home vis-a-vis someone that's manufacturing for sale. So it seems to me that that's not a wise omission to take that sentence out. Now, there could be another reason I'm not aware of, but that's the way I see that particular sentence. Is that on your draft, is that on page 17 as well, section 24?
They removed the section. However, the growing of marijuana for personal use is not manufacturing. And I will tell you that your question has been noted. We're not going to try to answer it at this time because we're taking part of the testimony.
I'm just kind of wondering if my pages are coinciding with your pages.
Okay, page is on our lines 10 and 11 on page 17.
There you go. So I think we're reasonably close to the same draft. My next concern... let's see. I apologize here. There is four different places under it's sections 45, 46, 47, and 48. These all relate to seizure or forfeiture, and I think that there's been a typo here. Four different places, you're adding the word bases, but you're spelling it B-A-S-E-S, and I believe that what you want to do is insert the word bases spelled B-A-S-I-S.
Mr. Chair, where is this?
Okay, hold on a little bit. We're on page, the one I'm looking at is page 26.
Oh.
27, I should say. Let's look at that one, line 11.
Well, it's on page 26, 27, and 28.
Oh, yeah, it's again there in 26, line 21. Again, your point is well taken. Please proceed.
I also wanted to speak to the overall wisdom of forfeiture laws. I have a brief real-world situation that I'd like to tell you about. Several years ago, I went out to visit a friend of mine that lives about a two-hour drive north of Anchorage. I took my large dog with me because she likes to run around in the woods with no fences. and I visited my friend who lives alone, and I got there. I had just got done rolling two joints, and the state troopers break in. Now, I had no idea, but it turned out my friend was growing marijuana in his crawl space. The troopers tried to tie me into the operation. They separated myself from the owner of the home. He stayed inside. They took me out to the driveway. And while in handcuffs, they continued to search. And when the trooper that was clearly in charge of the detachment or squad, he searched me, and I happened to have, just a coincidence, exactly $900 in my pocket. I had $920 when I left home, but I spent $20 on gas. And the trooper says, I think you're here to buy marijuana with this $900. I'm going to seize it. I said, you can't make that assumption. He said, I absolutely can. I said, well, you know, do you have a checking account? He goes, yes. I said, how much is in it? He goes, a few $100. I said, I don't have a bank account. My pocket is my checking account. When I get paid, I take my check to the bank, I cash it, and the money is in my pocket until it's gone. But it seemed that it was reasonably clear I was not going to win that argument. So the trooper went in to try to talk. He was going back and forth between myself and the homeowner, trying to trip one of us up into saying I was there to buy marijuana, which I wasn't. So nobody was going to say that because it wasn't true. Anyway, the trooper came back out. So I tried a new tack. I said very loudly, well, first I said in a normal voice, I said, well, if I'd had $7 in my pocket, that would have been okay, right? He goes, yeah. I said, but clearly $900 is a problem, right? He goes, yes. So I shouted as loud as I could, which got the attention of every trooper that was walking around this rural property looking in, you know, vehicles and sheds and whatnot. Every one of them, greenhouses, they snapped their head around to look at me as I shouted, so, how much money can you have before the police rob you? And the guy, the trooper looks at me and says, we aren't robbing you. I said, really? Why don't you look it up in the dictionary? You pointed guns at me and you took my money. That's the dictionary definition of robbery. Well, he didn't have an answer. He went back in to talk to the other guy. He came back out. I yelled it again. How much money can I... I said, you didn't answer my question. How much... I need to know. How much money can I have with me before the police rob me? He didn't ever answer the question, but he indeed finally gave me back my money. One of the things I'd said earlier is that you and I both know I'm not going to spend $1,000 for an attorney to get my $900 back. So I would suggest that there's several aspects of the forfeiture law that need to be addressed, starting with the fact, now I've seen reports in 60 Minutes, and I saw just in a fictionalized TV show just a few days ago, that police have been known to abuse that law and to seize property just because they get to keep it. So I would argue that there should be a provision in the law that says that property seized in no way can ever go to the law enforcement agency that seized it, so that they don't have an incentive to take things. I would also suggest the seizure should only be appropriate when issued by a judge. As part of the sentencing, it's totally fair for a judge to say, you get to forfeit this, that, and the other thing. But it's not fair for the law enforcement agency to be judge, jury, and executioner and to seize property knowing full well that the practicality is that you will never get it back. This is an instance in my case where I wasn't accused of a crime, I was never charged with a crime, and indeed I never would have been charged with a crime because I wasn't guilty of any crime. The only crime in the trooper's eyes was having more than whatever the legitimate amount is, which I'm still waiting to hear. How much money can you have before the police take it from you?
So, John, it really sounds like you've got an appreciation for the task that's before this committee, regulating marijuana at the same level that alcohol is regulated, as we are told to do by the initiative, is a tall order. And your input is taken seriously. We don't want to create a situation where the enforcement is inappropriate. So thanks for your time. We appreciate you taking time to call. We have a question for you here, John. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Mr. Farley, you mentioned the use of the term bases on page 26 and page 27. I see it twice. The plural of bases is bases. And this is simply the plural of basis. And I believe it's grammatically correct in all of those places for that reason.
From the top of my eye. I had one other concern on page 31 on the definition of possession in the third degree. Subsection 4, it's line 27 on page 31 of my draft. And one of the things that would trigger possession in the third degree, number 4, knowingly possesses marijuana with an aggregate weight of more than 1 ounce and less than 4 ounces. I would suggest that language is not does not line up with the prior court decisions based on the Raven decision that allow us to have 4 ounces in our own home.
Yeah, that's been noticed several times in the committee. So yeah, and we're working on that.
That particular line should be removed because that shouldn't be possession in the third degree if indeed it's consistent with other court rulings.
Great. So does that conclude your testimony today? Or?
Yes, sir. As far as I know, I have additional thoughts when it comes to when you consider the issue of regulating the commerce. And my biggest concern with that, and I know it's not germane to this particular bill, but in the state of Washington, they had a big problem because when they opened up the stores, there wasn't a legal supply to sell. So I would recommend that licenses for production should be issued perhaps about 3 months before licenses for sale, because that's about how long it takes to grow the plant and process it. 3 months.
Yeah, thank you. Just a, I'm going to get some clarification here from Abe, but there is another CS being drafted, and that's, you were expecting that one. Monday? Okay, so what you may want to do after sometime Monday or later, call to see what the version you have is probably version P, pop up in the far right-hand corner, and there'll be another one that we'll be addressing, we hope, on the Monday Judiciary Committee, but we don't know that for sure until it happens. So thank you for taking time to call in, John.
Well, thank you again for listening and working on this difficult issue.
Great. George Pierce, Kosilov.
This is from Kosilov.
Yes. George, identify yourself, who you represent, and give us your testimony, please.
My name is George Pierce. I'm calling from Kosilov, Alaska, and I'm representing myself and my friends.
Go ahead and give us your testimony.
I'd like to thank the House Judiciary Committee for taking my statements. The legislators should hear from the constituents on HB 79 before it's by itself, instead of putting other petition or other bills before this one. That way it cuts in time of the testimony for the people on HB 79. Cannabis is not physically addictive. You can use cannabis for many years and then give it up. Something I hear that is very hard for alcoholics, tobacco users, heroin, cocaine addicts, and pharmaceutical people. There's nothing in cannabis that programs the brain to crave harder drugs. Cannabis does not cause brain damage. That was debunked by the National Center for Toxicology Research. Cannabis doesn't cause violence. It actually suppresses violence. Okay, so all of that out of the way, now we are considering regulations. We should regulate marijuana like alcohol and nothing more. A study by the U.S. National Highway Safety Administration, marijuana and actual driving performance. The study looked at drivers under various dosages of cannabis on freeways and urban driving conditions. Concluded that intoxication in drivers does have some effect, but unlike alcohol, which appears to encourage risky driving, cannabis appears to produce caution in drivers. Because cannabis users are more aware than drunk drivers. Cannabis use may provide a safer substitute for other harmful drugs and even substitute for alcohol. We need to regulate alcohol and nothing added. No plea should be giving blood testing. You know, they are not doctors, and lawsuits will come from this happening. We have saliva or hair testing. Our legislators, you need to quit scaring the public with these blood testing. Too many restrictions. You're trying to make it more of a punishment. That is wrong to do. It is less dangerous than alcohol or harder drugs. You are trying to change this referendum to do how you want. Regulate it. Don't change it your way. Educate yourself and stop listening to the people that don't know anything about it. Some legislators stated in the Senate last week, Mr. Bill Wachowski, said alcohol, heroin, and cocaine have no medicinal purposes. That's not true. They use all of those for medicinal purposes. So you need to educate yourselves and quit comparing marijuana to cocaine, heroin, and alcohol. It's like comparing apples and oranges. Our Governor Walker has suggested that many regulations could be developed by a new marijuana board that shares resources with the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. So, you folks, I appreciate all your work, but you're making this thing like it's the worst thing in the world, and that's just not true. You really, really need to educate yourself, and if you don't want to educate yourself, you need to get somebody that's already educated in this field, and I'm sure there's tons of people that are out there. Thank you for allowing me to give you my testimony.
Thank you, George. Mystique Lockery, is it Mystique? Did I say it right? Lockery?
Yes.
If you would, identify ahead. Yourself and who you represent and give us your testimony.
This is Mystique Lockery from Fairbanks, Alaska. I represent myself and all other Alaskans. I would like to thank each of you for your hard work and effort as you create legislation to comply with Measure 2. The newest version of this bill is a vast improvement over the previous version, and I congratulate you for these steps in the right direction. I agree with one of the previous callers. A close look should be taken at the forfeiture laws, and something should be done about them. And that caller recommended a 3-month period to grow ahead of time for sales opening. I would say 4 months to grow ahead of time at the very least, but longer would be better for businesses to be prepared for opening. I would like to voice concern over a couple of points. Section 17.38.020 must not be repealed. The legal protections need to stay intact. It would be wrong to go against the intention of the measure and the will of the people by criminalizing the possession of more than 1 ounce of personally grown marijuana in a person's home. It is allowed under ballot measure 2 to grow 6 plants and have the produce of those plants in your home. It would be wrong to make it criminal to have healthy, well-producing plants. Sometimes plants produce a lot, and sometimes they produce only a little. People shouldn't have the threat of being in trouble because their plants happen to be doing well. Of course, Raven must not be affected in any way by any legislation put forth. That is directly and specifically addressed in the wording of Measure 2. It would be underhanded to try and legislate away Raven. Raven is a long-standing cornerstone of Alaska case history, and to try to subvert its ruling would be wrong on many levels. I believe a number of years ago, some people in Alaska tried to do something along that line, maybe through an initiative, but it was repealed because it was found to be unconstitutional. Trying to do the same thing now, legislation would still be unconstitutional, and it shouldn't even be considered. Concerning the ban on the use of marijuana in public places, a privately owned business that chooses to allow marijuana use on its premises or a business that is set up to include that purpose particularly should be allowed to do that. if someone objects to the choice of that business, they are free to show that by patronizing other businesses. The smoke of marijuana does not have the same harmful effects as cigarette smoke, so it does not pose the same danger to patrons or employees. I see a cartoon commercial on TV all the time. Part of it talks about how marijuana can cause heart disease and COPD. Those statements are untrue. Dr. Donald Toshkin, the lead pulmonary research scientist for the federal government for over 30 years, proved over those decades that marijuana does not cause lung cancer and does not lead to COPD. That is on the record scientific fact. It is recorded in the research data. I sent each of you an email on January 28th to let you know I spoke to Donald Toshkin on the phone, and he said he was willing to testify before you and answer any questions you have. I have tried to contact the Rosecrans Foundation, the organization who runs that cartoon commercial, to let them know of the inaccuracy of the commercial, and I invited them to speak with Dr. Toshkin, the foremost authority on the subject. But I've never heard back from them. Unfortunately, many organizations are more interested in spreading their message than they are in making sure their message is correct. I appreciate your willingness to take on this big project with the highest integrity and the goal of handling it with the facts based on science in mind. Another point, the THC and CBD and the many other useful compounds in marijuana can be absorbed in several ways, and it's very important to allow people to use it in whatever way works best for them. Smoking, vaporizing, eating, drinking, and topically should all be available and non-criminal. Whether being used medically or recreationally, edibles, which some people believe are much healthier for them than smoking, should in no way be kept from them. It is unreasonable to keep something from adults because you don't want children to have it. I heard that Cynthia Franklin, the director of the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, said she would be able to have regulations ready, including edibles, in a timely manner, causing no delays. I commend her for that, and I encourage you to work with her towards those ends. I would also like to make a small correction to something said on Wednesday. A man was talking about testing and mentioned that the THC stays in your system for 30 to 90 days. What stays in your system for 30 to 90 days is an inert leftover residue just waiting to leave the body. It is not active in any way. It is like the ash in a fireplace. It is not producing heat like the wood did. It is not active in any way, but is just waiting to be swept out. Once again, I would like to thank each of you for your hard work, and thank you for hearing the testimony and taking it into consideration.
Yeah, thank you, Mystique. If you would fax that testimony to us, makes it easier to double-check. We'd appreciate that. Thank you for taking time to call, and thank you for your patience in us getting to you. Mary Jane Peterson.
Do you want me to email this, what I have just said to you?
I'm sorry?
You wanted me to email what I have just said to you?
Yes, please.
All right, I will do that. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Mary Jane Peterson, are you online? Mary Jane from Palmer. And I see no others online. She's still there, maybe just not quite found the mute button or whatever. Mary Jane, are you there? While we're waiting, if you get on there, go ahead and talk to us.
Hello,
Mary Jane. If you would identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please. Sorry you had to wait so long.
Well, that's okay. I'm Mary Jane Peterson from Palmer, Alaska, and I'm representing myself. I've been an activist for this cause for many years. And I would encourage you to support this bill and to give it a chance. And the legislature must not repeal voter-enacted legal protections for personal possession, use, and cultivation. Thank you for listening for our testimonies.
Thank you, Mary Jane. Anybody else online? Anybody in the room that wants to testify on this? I have a testimony in front of us. I'll read this real quick. It's a paragraph, very clear and laid out here. It's so easy, so I'll read it into the record for Dr. George L. Stewart, M.D. he says HB 79 is critically needed. Marijuana is a toxic substance with known effects on cognitive performance. its use must be regulated in the same way alcohol is, no driving, flying airplanes, or other activities which require a high level of cognitive performance. Although use of marijuana is a personal choice, people using it should not put others at risk. Police should be able to arrest those driving under the influence of marijuana just as they do those driving under the influence of alcohol. HB 79 clarifies the legal issues related to arrests and court procedures resulting from marijuana consumption and is critically needed to protect the safety of non-consumers in Alaska. Please vote yes on HB 79. So with that, I think we're done. Does the committee have any closing comments or not? Okay, the next meeting is Tom Mundy at 1 o'clock, and we're adjourned.